Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In his new book, the journalist Thomas Frank offers a passionate critique of Massachusetts Democrats and the booming economy that they've helped create. He calls Boston the spiritual home of the professional class and a place where modern liberalism has grown and flourished without restraint. He calls it a liberalism of the rich. Frank says it has helped fuel a booming innovation economy, but also the highest rates of economic disparity in the nation. Thomas Frank came in recently to talk about this and about his new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He says the Massachusetts economy and the politics of this very blue state have been shaped in a big way by the high number of private colleges and universities and their close relationship with business.
Well, Route 128 is a sort of classic example, and MIT is the classic example of the university that has launched, you know, so many business enterprises, mainly in high tech and in defense contracting. These are all industries that the Democratic Party loves to celebrate and to talk about how noble they are and how the people who work there are really high quality people. You know, basically this class of people who innovate. And this is, you know, no big surprise here. This is the same group of people that the Democratic Party looks to as constituency number one in their coalition of voters, the white collar professionals. This
right.
is their most favored group of constituents.
You also point out, so here we are with this booming knowledge economy and this booming innovation economy, but we also have the highest rates of income disparity, yawning gap between rich and poor. So how do the policies that encourage the innovation economy and the knowledge economy feed that wealth gap?
Mainly because they don't care about it. You know, this is once you decide that the only people that really matter in your economic worldview are members of the, you know, the white collar professional class, and keeping them happy is very important, and making sure that it's really easy for people to innovate. But at the same time, switching off your concern about working people, well, that's naturally what's going to happen. By the way, this is not unique to Massachusetts. This is happening everywhere that you have these sort of boomtown economies.
You put a pretty fine point on the critique when it comes to Boston. At one point, you say Boston is the headquarters for two industries, higher education and big medicine, that are steadily bankrupting middle-class America. And I wanted to ask you, is it really fair to say that the Democrats that run this very blue state and city are responsible for the runaway costs of healthcare and higher ed? Because I guess one could argue that they spend a lot of time worrying about how to control those costs.
Look, it is Democrats and liberals who have given us this sort of modern idea we have that everybody must go to college, that college is the only way to succeed. It's the only way to raise yourself up in the world, you know, not by hard work or something like that, but by going to college, by studying very specific things. And they have drummed this, I should say drilled this, into a generation of students and also of parents. And everybody in America knows this. They have to send their kid to college. What do the colleges do? What do they do when you say that they basically control the gates to the middle class way of life? Well, of course they keep jacking up the prices every year, 5% every year. And look, the Democrats have it in their power to do something about this, but they would rather not. They choose not to. These are their friends. These are their classmates. If you look at who donates to Democrats, university systems are always way up there, right up there with Wall Street, actually. Yeah.
And when you say that the Democrats have the power to do something else, what specifically are you talking about? Because you're really describing a major shift from the kind of Rooseveltian New Deal idea of what the Democrats should be or could be and are not, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they could have a completely – they don't have to have a worldview where the university is the center and focus and the sort of, the hub, if you will, of the universe. You know, that not everybody thinks about the world that way. That's a specifically – it's a way of looking at the world that belongs to a specific class. There's also, in policy terms, things that they could be doing differently. I mean, President Obama has enormous power over the universities of America. And he's talked about, you know, about doing things to rein in the annual tuition increase. But the stuff that he's proposed is very weak indeed. But you look at what the Department of Education gives to these institutions, to these universities, or you look at the tax breaks that these universities get from the cities that host them. There's all sorts of ways that they could be reined in. But nobody has the will. Nobody wants to.
Speaking of tax breaks and the way local policy supports the innovation economy, I want to listen to a couple of cuts of tape. So as you probably know, General Electric is moving its headquarters to Boston. So here's Jeff Immelt. He's the CEO of GE, talking about the company's decision to move its headquarters to Boston. GE is getting $150 million in tax incentives. Now, GE is giving $50 million worth of philanthropy to Boston Public Schools. So here's Immelt, who says this will benefit the city and the state in a big way.
Over time, the returns are going to be vast to the people of Boston, the people of Massachusetts, in terms of job creation, investment in the community, salaries, real estate, things like that. This is an investment that ought to be really great for the people in Boston.
And Tom Frank, one more piece of tape. This is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, a rock-solid pro-union Democrat, talking about the benefits of giving tax breaks to a company like GE. Here's what he said.
There's an opportunity here, bringing in one of the largest companies in the world to invest in our city. The spinoff of that for taxes, which will be reinvested back in our economy, back into our schools, our police, our fire, you can't put a figure on that.
So there are two sort of arguments for developing and supporting the innovation economy. Is Mayor Walsh wrong to say that, do you think?
Basically, the argument is, you know, Republicans have their sort of version of this where, you cut taxes and you lure companies to your city. Either way, you are, as a city, abasing yourself before a certain class of people. Hmm. You know, it's not something that you want to see in a democracy.
Hmm. And as an example of where you observed the wealth gap, you know, really dramatically in this state, you compared what you observed in Boston, like, you know, in the Innovation District, with what you saw in a city like Fall River. Right?
Yeah.
So describe that contrast.
It's a manufacturing city, a manufacturing town. Manufacturing has all gone overseas. What's most striking about Fall River is that the factories haven't been torn down. They're all still there. And so as you drive around the city, that kind of puts you in this sort of contemplative mood, thinking about the time when blue-collar people were the vast majority of Americans were the ones that we made policy for. They were the ones that we tried to benefit. And we did to some degree, by the way. From the Great Depression up until the 1990s, or the 1980s anyway, when the country prospered, working-class people prospered too, and wage growth, economic growth was distributed to the bottom 90% of the population as well. Since the last few years of the Bill Clinton administration, the late 90s, all that economic growth has gone to the top 10% or so. And that's a question of policy. That's not, you know, the invisible hand of God that came down and did that. We did that. And by and large, Democrats did that.
See, it's interesting that you say it's not the invisible hand of God, because I think one of the arguments that you'll hear, I mean, to talk about an example like Fall River, people will say, well, this is the result of deindustrialization, global business trends that have created new winners and new losers, right?
That's like saying a crime wave is caused by more crime. Seriously. So when people talk about globalization, by the way, Democrats in particular love to talk about globalization. They think it's so virtuous. You know, we all know what globalization is. It's when we move blue collar work overseas and get that stuff done much more cheaply. And that's just what globalization is. And, you know, it's as though the sort of, you know, the forces of the globe itself were doing this to us. But no. Trade agreements are written by humans. They're not written by the globe. They're written by humans. They're, in fact, written mainly by lobbyists nowadays. And what those lobbyists do in those trade agreements is they figure out ways to advance their own interests and harm the interests of other groups.
Hmm.
And all of our trade agreements are written this way. Can I tell you something that I learned when I was writing this book?
Yes, please.
You could write a trade agreement to benefit any group and to harm any other group. I can give you an example. We could import high-quality lawyers and doctors into this country in enormous numbers, and it would be gravely harmful to the professional class in this country. And we could ensure quality standards, and we could import generic pharmaceuticals from India, and we could ensure quality standards. It would be the end of Big Pharma. They'd be the ones deindustrialized. But you know who it would be good for? be good for average citizens. It'd be good for blue-collar people who have to pay $1,000 a pill or who have to pay so much to go and see their doctor. It would make legal services very, very cheap. You could do this.
So it's policy, not the invisible hand.
It's not the globe doing this. It's the people in Washington, D.C. who negotiated these treaties, and they chose one group over another group, and that is all there is to it.
But, Tom, I mean, it's practically an article of faith in this part of the world that innovation is a good thing. I mean, is...
Yeah, well, you hear that everywhere you go. I mean, people talk about it as though it was a kind of a form of charity. When you do innovation, you're automatically benefiting mankind. But then you look back over the history of innovation and the kind of things that innovation has given us. I mean, Enron was a very, very innovative company. And lest we forget, you know, the instruments that brought the global economy to its knees in 2008 were financial innovations, right? These were things that Democrats used to celebrate. I mean, innovations are not automatically a force for good. I mean, they have to be judged on the merits the same as everything else. It's like talking about globalization. It's just a way of putting over something that should be scrutinized, something that might even be controversial, like Uber, and just saying, oh, nothing to see here. This is just innovation. It's just, you know, God's in his heaven. All's right with the world.
Right. Now, you mentioned Uber. I just want to get you to explain that. What's wrong with Uber? It makes it easier for me.
It's very convenient, right?
Yeah. Convenient for people like me.
Yes, exactly.
It costs less. They come when I call and they take me where I want to go the way I want to go.
Exactly. But what about the people who shed their blood building a taxi driver's union over the years and you know, making sure that certain safety rules were in place and making sure that this was a job that you could live on? And now it's basically Uber has opened up what will essentially, I think, become a race to the bottom. And you can extend that logic to so many. And of course, the innovators are extending that logic to so many other different fields of enterprise and of work and of labor. And it's a formula for casualizing any kind of labor.
Yeah. And in the case of Uber, I pay less, but the driver gets less. But then the unionized driver becomes obsolete. And the people
right.
who are making the big money are the innovators.
Right. Back in Silicon Valley. Right.
So what were the forces that caused the sort of powerful Democrats to shift away from the New Deal style of Democratic policies toward this new kind of, third way style of Democratic policies?
Yeah, it has a long history. And it, you know, goes back to the days of the Vietnam War, when organized labor, as you might recall, was you know, by and large supported President Johnson on Vietnam, and things, you know, the country was seemed to be coming apart in those days, and the Democrats basically decided they would remove organized labor from a structural position within the Democratic Party. Organized labor looked pretty bad in those days. You know, you can understand them making that decision, but what they didn't get at the time is that when you remove workers' organizations, when you take their voice away, you're also taking away workers' issues. You're taking away, you know, and you're basically setting the table for what has happened ever since, which is towering inequality. And today they think it's working. Today they think they'll be able to win the White House from here to eternity.
What about people like Senator Elizabeth Warren? She's a Democrat who seems to be raising the alarm about oversized rewards of the rich. Is she the exception among Democrats in your view?
I think so, yeah. I think she is an exception. You know, and Bernie Sanders is another one. And it's not a coincidence, by the way, that Bernie Sanders, for all those years, was not a Democrat, didn't identify himself as a Democrat. It's very interesting. And Elizabeth Warren also comes to the Democratic Party from an unusual place, by which I mean Oklahoma, and by which I mean being a Republican, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, are you encouraged at all by the race for the Democratic nomination? You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He talks a lot about income inequality. Whether he wins or not, do you think his message is resonating and perhaps pushing Hillary Clinton in the country?
I'm very excited by what I'm seeing. And now, look, I'm a journalist. I can read newspapers, and I fully expect that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. I mean, the party is united behind her, even if the voters aren't. But I think she'll be the nominee. And if the Republicans choose Donald Trump, I think Hillary Clinton will be the president. But I also think she will be a fairly conservative president, by which I mean nothing will change. You know, the center will hold and inequality will grow worse. All the problems that we're talking about here will get worse. And 4 years from now, you're going to see another Bernie Sanders, but you're also going to see another Donald Trump. You know, this is just going to grow in the next couple of years.
Well, Thomas Frank is a journalist. His new book is called Listen, Liberal. You can find a link to his piece that was adapted from the book about Massachusetts and the blue state model, how the Democrats created a liberalism of the rich, at RadioBoston.org. Thomas Frank, thanks so much. This has been great.
It's my pleasure.
Yep, so that's one point of view. And check out Thomas Frank's piece and let us know what you think. You can leave a comment at RadioBoston.org, or you can tweet us or leave a comment on Facebook at Radio Boston as well. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.